Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Coming up on this week's show, more Mario 64 secrets found 3 decades later.
A legendary classic lands on the Mega Drive.
And we talk with video game legends Tony Warriner and Stu Cambridge about their new game for the Spectrum next.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you every Friday with our sponsor, our friends at Bitmap Books. Now, if you love adventure games, a book I absolutely adore of theirs, have you seen The Art of Point-and-Click Adventures? Now, this covers all the big games from the earliest examples of Sierra games, going through the LucasArts adventures into stuff like Secret of Monkey Island, The Dig, Full Throttle, Myst is in there as well, Discworld, Blade Runner, spanning an incredible 528 pages. You can order that right now and have a look at the rest of their retro gaming collection on their website at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 481, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the show. You know, the podcast that every single week is all about what's been happening in the wonderful world of retro gaming and technology, bringing you up to speed on the big stories from over the last week and welcoming on veterans of the industry to tell us their story on an interview in the second half of the show every week. And now that we are definitely into the midst of summer, about as warm as it gets here in the UK, it does mean full-on event season now. I know you guys have been all over the place over the last couple of weeks. You were over in Birmingham last weekend, Joe?
Yeah, I was at the Birmingham Games Market. That was really fun. Slinging Mega Drive games on my mate Jason's stand. It was always really fun. Said hello to a few people as well who came and said hello and stuff, which is always great. It was really nice. Weird, though, because people always recognise me from my voice.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, because they probably just hear me being gobby on the stand.
But, do you ever get that thing where people are like, you look nothing like I expected you to?
No, I don't think anybody's ever said that to me, to be fair. But I did ask somebody, and I'm really sorry I didn't catch your name. I was like, did you recognise me from my voice or from the look of me? And he said, oh, I have seen a picture before. So he was like, I kind of waited for you to start talking. And I was like, yeah, that's Joe. Which is really cool. Like, I'm making out like I'm super famous or something. It was like 3-4 people, but that's still really cool. And really
I just
nice.
Remember someone said to me once when they recognised my voice, they're like, I expected you to be really short, dumpy and fat. This was 15 years ago. I actually am that now. So I've kind of grown into my voice, I suppose. It is like event season. Ravi and I are heading over to Norway as well in a couple of months, well into the planning for Retro Messa. That's going to be on the 16th and 17th of August in a beautiful, picturesque Sandefjord. Oh, in Norway,
looking
for
forward
bet.
To that. A fantastic show. We've got quite a few patrons coming over as well, which is always really nice. We have a good little crew when we're over there.
Yeah, so want to get tickets to that and check out the Retro Hour live, because we are going to be on stage hosting panels as always. I'll put a link in the show notes, but retromessa.no for your tickets. And loads of events have been happening as well, sort of Zap last weekend as well in the West Midlands. A lot of people might have seen our guests on the podcast this week at Zap demoing their new game, which is called Herb X Warriors. Now, this is a new title brought to us by two absolute superstars of the British retro gaming world. This is Tony Warriner, who you probably know from Revolution Software, games like Beneath the Steel Sky and Broken Sword, and Stu Cambridge, who was the artist at Sensible Software and worked on games like Cannon Fodder and SWAS back in the day, and they've hooked up for a new game.
Yeah, so they've hooked up for a new game, and it's quite interesting because you've got two developers here, you know, from back in the old school, but also with some fantastic kind of very British companies with some good humour in there as well. So, you know, I always looked at the humour of Beneath a Steel Sky. There was some great stuff in there. And also, you know, Cannon Fodder and Sensible Soccer. Sensible Software was always a funny company. And they're kind of making a unique title, which is coming out on a quite unique machine as well, which is the Spectrum Next.
Yeah, now I'm excited about this. Because I mentioned before on the podcast, I'm kind of into these kind of, you know, continuations of retro machines. I've got a Mega 65, which is kind of a souped-up Commodore 8-bit, and I've also got the Spectrum Next, which was a community effort. We've done entire episodes about that before. That is an open-source kind of continuation of what the Spectrum could have become, and there are lots of different ways to get involved in the Spectrum Next world. Of course, as I said, open source. You can either, they're going to be doing a third Kickstarter, they did announce recently, if you want to get hold of the actual official machine. But also there's Mike Daly's incredible C-Spec emulator, so you can play Spectrum Next games on your PC. There's also lots of kind of clones and stuff around as well, so it's really easy to get into that world. And I've heard this new game they're doing, which is going to be a Kickstarter that launches next Wednesday, last Wednesday of May. And this is meant to be a title from everything I've heard about this. And obviously, you spoke to them more on the interview about it, Ravi. Again, that really pushes the Spectrum Next really to its limits.
Apparently, some people couldn't believe it was actually coming out of the Next, you know, when they were playing it, because it's such high quality. But, you know, you kind of expect it from these guys. The thing about this is the Next is becoming a kind of a primary platform for development, you know, which is really exciting having all those tools there as well. And I guess that's one of the original aims of the project, is to, you know, get games out there. And then they're getting ported as well. So this Herb X Warriors is getting ported onto the PlayStation. It's going to be on the Amiga. It's going to be on the Dreamcast, the PC and the Mac as well. Nice. So, you know, this is being used as its primary platform. And it's great to hear these two different developers from different companies coming together, getting ideas together, how they kind of created it, how the coding went into it as well. Because Stu Cambridge, he's a Commodore guy, you know, he's originally not really done much with the Spectrum. So, you know, jumping onto this new system and how this whole game works is fantastic. I think they've formed a great little company here.
Yeah, so looking forward to hearing more about that with our special guests, good friends of the podcast, Tony Warriner and Stu Cambridge, talking about their new game, Herb X Warriors, and lots more as well. They're on the show in around half an hour from now. But you know the way the first half of the podcast works, that's when we have a little round table about what's been happening in the world of retro from over the last week. The stories, a lot of which you submitted on our Discord. We do have a little news section in there. If you spot anything during the week, link to our Discord server on the website at theretrohour.com, and the things that have caught our attention as well. Now, our first one is, we always love finding out new secrets that have been discovered in classic video games. We've talked quite a bit in the past, actually, about people finding new things in Mario 64. And it turns out there are some very interesting behaviours demonstrated in Mario 64 when you leave the game running for a long time.
Yeah, so people are saying, you know, secrets, bugs, glitches, whatever you want to call it. I don't really know which one it would come under. Maybe a secret. But more interesting than anything, and I always find it funny when people find these crazy things, you know, what, 29 years later now for for Mario 64, but this is a YouTuber called Kaze Ammonia, I believe is how you say it. And what he's essentially found is within the data of Mario 64 that there is essentially an internal clock in the game, which is 14 months. So what he's found is some instances in the game where if you, you know, kind of like, what's the word I'm looking for? Out time, out, you know, like run out the clock, outrun the clock, leave it for 14 months. Obviously, he hasn't left an N64 running for 14 months. We'll get onto that in a second. Certain sound effects in the games will run their course. So, for example, there's a shark in one of the levels, which makes like a, is it like a chomping noise?
Yeah, it makes a sound every 16 frames.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, well, his sound effect is 16 frames, but in the game, it resets every 14 frames. Mm. So you never actually hear the final two frames of the sound effect or the end of the sound effect unless the game runs for 14 months, because that's how long the internal clock is for the sound effect.
And it maxes out then, yeah.
So it maxes out, so you actually hear the last 2 seconds of the last two frames of the sound effect, which have never been heard before, although right. I believe they're just the same sound effect, but technically they've never been heard before, and then the game will stop making that sound effect, you know, which is quite interesting. And there's a few instances of this happening. Rainbow Cruiser level, the giant ship that you have to stay on, which kind of flies around the level, which is actually one of my favorite levels from when I was a kid, that actually makes like a constant, you know, wing flapping noise throughout the level, because it's the wings of the ship flapping. But once again, if you leave it 14 months, the sound of the wings will disappear, and all you will hear is like kind of like the soundtrack of the level. Obviously, he's not left this for 14 months. He's used emulation, and I think he's used code to, I could be wrong, but he's essentially used code to not trick the game, but program the game so that the 14 months have passed.
Yeah, it's going quicker, yeah.
I think, you know, I'm no programming expert or anything, but I think it's the way that it's been coded. It's kind of set in this change, you know, this like limitation that happens, and it's a certain amount of frames that it hits. So maybe he's sped up how that's going to work. And this is also a thing that's just not exclusive to Super Mario 64 as well. There's loads of other games where, you know, people have been coding it. They've left things in there and stuff, and strange things happen if you leave it for a long time. Like Red Dead Redemption 2 has some stuff in there as well. It's interesting. It's probably something that's never going to happen unless you're looking for it, you know. People aren't going to sit there unless they've left their console on for a very long time in a specific location, you know. But for kind of completionists of these glitches and bugs, this is news.
There are some that you can see a bit sooner as well. Cause I mean, you're right there. The way it works is, I mean, and this is still a thing in games today. Like you said, Ravi, that, you know, games track time using counters, which eventually will reach their maximum value, and then they overflow. And floating point numbers are sometimes used to track time, as in Mario 64. And they eventually get to a point where they can't accurately predict the next number and then the stop. So there is some other bugs that you can see as well, that or interesting behaviours when this happens, that you don't need it to leave it on as long, actually. There's some in Mario 64. For example, if you're in the Dia Dia Docks painting room, if Mario doesn't move for 6.5 days, then the ripple effect on the painting stops.
Okay.
And weirdly, there's some, like, for example, in the Wii Virtual Console version, there is a rounding error that causes a platform in Bowser in the Fire Sea to slowly rise. Now, what it means in this is, after a few days, this platform rises to the second floor, and it means you can then jump across the entire top of the world, so you can beat the entire level, which is kind of cool. And there are some other bugs in there as well, again, and some other rippling paintings that kind of stop. So, yeah, I mean, it's like you said, I think, obviously, this is present in other games as well, but we didn't see them back in the day. I think the longest I ever left one of my machines on might have been 1.5 days, because I remember we got to a certain point and had to go to school, me and my friends, so we left it, the computer, on during the day while we were out. My mum saw it, she'd have turned it off. So, yeah, definitely wasn't allowed to leave it on for 6.5 days, never mind 14 months.
We did that with Paperboy. Me and my brother had got the furthest we'd ever got on it, like probably like the third level. on the Mega Drive version, and we left it on to go out for the day. It wasn't school. We were like going out for the day for something with our family. And we put a blanket over the Mega Drive so my mum wouldn't see the light.
Nicely cooking it.
Yeah, and we were so like, oh my God, like mum's going to kill us if we leave it on. And we got home and I remember the Mega Drive was so hot and we went on it and immediately died about 10 seconds later in the game. But going back to the subject of the Mario 64 thing, I always remember, you know, especially on 16-bit systems and maybe a little bit on, you know, PlayStation and N64 and stuff, but the soundtrack, you know, on levels, if you were spending a long time in a particular area, kind of like running its course and, you know, it would end and then start again in some games. Sometimes, obviously, it'd be on a loop where the rhythm of the song would never end because, obviously, it's just looping. But, yeah, it's interesting to see, you know, you don't really think about it with constant sound effects, if you will, you know, that are there constantly.
I was always too impatient as well. I'd sometimes get, you know, Sonic looking at the camera and tapping his foot. I'd occasionally see that. And I remember Archie MacLean's pool, it might have been on the Amiga, where if you leave it long enough, little flies start flying around the room and then the pool balls start pulling funny faces at you.
Mm.
I remember that was quite cool when you saw stuff like that. But yeah, definitely couldn't be a kid like me and leave you, not do anything on it for like, 6.5 days. But yeah, very interesting behaviour. So if you want to see that and maybe if you find any more as well, there is a little community effort to track down other strange behaviours on games that max out their timers. So I'll put that video in the show notes. Now, it's always cool to see games coming to a platform that it wasn't released on back in the day. And obviously, Metal Gear games are massive. Never officially released on a Sega console during the time that Sega made hardware, despite, you know, 4 games coming out in that period. I think the one of the workarounds I saw was people were running Metal Gear Solid via Bleemcast.
Yeah.
In the PlayStation version on the Dreamcast as well. But now, Metal Gear has officially landed on the Sega Mega Drive.
Yeah, so like you say, the original Metal Gear came out on the MSX2, the NES, which was a different version of the game, C64 and MS-DOS never came out on Mega Drive or Master System, etc. But Hoffman recently ported this to the Amiga, and then people are saying this is a port of the Amiga version onto the Mega Drive, which Ravi tells me isn't all that it seems.
You're kind of not just using the Amiga sound there. You're using the Mega Drive's chip as well. And
the Yamaha.
Yes. Oh. Listening to this soundtrack, oh my God, it sounds good. Like the bass is absolutely horrific. So the audio is done by Ice Dragon D.
Is that horrific in a good way, yeah?
Oh, horrifically good, yeah.
Bad means good, yeah.
Yeah, it is like just beautiful if you listen to the demo. Oh, yeah, it's just absolutely fantastic. And I think, you know, these ports by Hoffman are really good at the moment. He's, you know, addressing different systems that didn't originally get these, but also he's been working on some demos as well. You know, he's a demo coder, he's a DJ as well. Vaporous is the demo that he recently released at Revision 2025, and you know, that's a demo for the Neo Geo as well. So he's been coding some Neo Geo stuff. He's doing a Neo Geo port of Shinobi and also Golden Axe at the moment. So, you know, he's producing a lot of stuff. And what I like about Hoffman's productions is they're very accurate. They play well, but then the sound has that little tune up and it has that little change in the music. And, you know, his DJ experience goes into that. And also his kind of knowledge of the chip music and the chip tunes there. It supports 6-button controllers as well as 3-button as well. So it's got 2 different modes there.
Yeah, with that you can access your items quicker, which is pretty good, using the 6-button controller. Multiple languages in the games as well. There's also some new visual elements in the game. Updated character portraits that have been done during codec scenes by Tony Galves, originally for the Amiga version. They're in the Mega Drive version now as well. Looking, I mean, there's a video I'll put in the show notes if you want to check it out. Looks gorgeous, doesn't it? No sprite flickering, no slowdowns. Looks butter smooth.
It looks too clean.
Yeah, compared to the NES
like,
version.
Yeah, it looks like a really clean version of it. I've only briefly played, you know, the original and then the NES version. I've only played them for like 10, 15 minutes. But I don't remember them looking that smooth. But like you say, like, a, you know, especially the codec clips, you know, that looks really like bright and just, you know, the only way I can describe it is clean. Like, yeah, it's not as pixelated. It's a strange look because it's very clearly like an 8-bit game running on 16-bit hardware. But it does look really, really good.
Yeah, and it's, as Ravi mentioned, Mega Drive port, it's native. Takes advantage of the Mega Drive hardware as well, not emulation. So it is great to see, you know, proper native 16-bit version of the game. Nice to have some improvements as well for both Mega Drive and Metal Gear fans too. So if you want to get a hold of that, that is on Hoffman's Itch page now. It's one of those name your own price games as well, so pay what you think it's worth. But yeah, I mean, as you said, Ravi, he's been doing some incredible stuff recently. So very excited to have a play at this at the weekend, and I can't wait to see what he does next. So if you want to check that out, I'll link that in the show notes too. Now, Microsoft have been making the headlines again recently. We did mention that they're celebrating their 50th year this year. One thing I thought was quite interesting, the Microsoft Build event has been on this week. Did you see that they've revived the DOS edit command?
Yeah, I saw two things. I saw one, they'd recreated the old Microsoft offices, which was really cool with these like modern machines without tiers.
We'll get onto that in a minute because that's a big story. Yeah.
Oh, okay. We're going to jump into that. But first, we'll look at the build command. So this is edit, right? So yeah. When you
were used MS-DOS back in the day, edit space autoexec.bat.
And yeah, that's your life back in the day. When it was a command line, and edit was built into the shell. Now, I have not used Windows for a long time. That's really bad for me to say. At work, I've used those machines, but I've converted to the dark side and I use the Mac. So from what I remember was, I think it was PowerShell. That's what I used to use. Do you have a modern Windows machine there, Dan?
I do. I mean, my main machine's a Mac. We're Mac boys. I know some people are going to be booing at us. But I do have a Windows 11 PC, which I occasionally, you know, there are certain times when you might need to do a screen recording and only a certain capture card will only work with Windows or a certain weird bit of hardware.
And you have to get into the command line, yeah.
Yeah, occasionally. And yeah, I mean, you know, I do have PowerShell, I think that is it, on my PC. But yeah, I mean, I haven't, you know, years since I obviously most of us I haven't edited autoexec.bats in many years, but yeah, I mean, edit was always a command that you used back in the day. But it seems that Microsoft have built this week in one of their more unusual announcements is bringing it back to CMD on the on Windows 11. And
it's weird because I never knew that it was missing, you know. It was
same,
one of those
same
things
if I'm honest.
That I'd probably just type in automatically and be like, oh, it doesn't work, you know. The amount of games that I would be configuring files with edit and just, you know, using it as a quick access. It's like kind of standard. It's built into the blood of it. So I'd say the story is, why was it removed?
Yeah. I mean, I'd assume I always use Notepad if I want to edit something like that on Windows, obviously these days, but it's pretty cool to see this. I mean, you can get it from their GitHub. It's open source, which is pretty cool, and it's only 256 kilobytes, and there's no Copilot or AI or anything like that in it, which I imagine
we've launched AI edits.
Yeah, so
AI does.
I haven't tried it yet, but from the screenshots I've seen, it looks like it could have been straight out of MS-DOS 5 or something back in the day. So it's got that kind of retro MS-DOS aesthetic, so that's very cool to see.
I must say, I've been trying the new Windows, and I don't really see much difference with the older stuff. It just all seems a bit like complex and harder to lock off. And I just go in the settings and change everything, like the start menu to be on the left. And
They got rid of the classic theme, though. You can't put that on anymore.
The old one, yeah. Maybe there's a new cool mega way of using it. But yeah, I'm kind of massively out of touch with that.
Well, that wasn't the only thing at Build this week. Microsoft have been giving a rather big nod to their history with the original Build activation. Now, this is where a lot of people might be familiar with Linus Tech Tips, who's a great YouTuber. He did a video recently saying, Bill Gates asked me to upgrade his first PC, where he built what, you know, a sleeper PC is. Yeah, this is where they put basically state-of-the-art modern gaming hardware into an ancient-looking PC case. And he actually did this with the old Altair, from back in the day, which is part of this exhibition that has been at Microsoft Build this week, which is a room that takes you back to Microsoft in 1975, complete with 1970s furniture and
Rolodex on the desk. You know, there's some wood grain there, filing cabinets.
A lot of brown suits.
The only thing that's missing is the cigarettes. You know, but looking at these photos, it is really accurate. And I think that's really cool to see, because we have seen museums do, you know, rooms from the past and kind of recreate them. But, you know, actually coming from a company and doing a tribute to it's good. Of course, it's a bit different. It's being delivered by Copilot as well, this emulation. Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's quite cool. I'd love to actually go in there and just spend a day completely geeking out, playing on the old phones and, you know, just printing stuff on a really noisy dot matrix printer.
It's interesting because this exhibition's in a few different parts, and a lot of it centres around the Altair 8800, which that kind of goes back to the earliest days of Microsoft when, you know, Bill Gates and Paul Allen first started the company. And that was their first kind of commercial product that they made a version of BASIC. Because obviously Microsoft were very famous for BASIC back in the day before the IBM deal when DOS came along, and they sold it to MITS, which was a company behind the Altair, who shipped Microsoft BASIC on their machines. So you can actually use the original version of Microsoft BASIC on a machine that looks like an Altair. There's actually an Arduino running in there to emulate it. And then there are a bunch of Easter eggs that people who check out the exhibition can unlock in there, including stuff like photos of Bill and Paul and early recruitment documents as well, a lot of the older creative concepts and the design, and there's a lot of ASCII art and stuff around the room too. But then you can also check out the that sleeper build that Linus Tech Tips made as well, which is basically a state-of-the-art gaming PC inside an old Altair case.
And
which,
also they've got some like limited edition merch as well that they've put out there, which looks better than any of the Microsoft merch that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It always looks really dry. This looks old school. And, you know,
the old Microsoft logo.
Yeah. And the one thing that's missing is, you know, Steve Ballmer running in there like, guys, come on.
Developers, developers, developers.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I'd just love to go there and play around on this stuff.
I love seeing that, because I know we've been to the Centre of Computing History in Cambridge.
Yeah.
And they've got a room there, haven't they? Like a 70s office. A Commodore PET's in there, I think. Yeah, it's really cool to see stuff like this. So if you were there at Build this week and maybe took some pictures, we'd love to see them. But I'll link up that article. Get a little look at that. And nice to see Microsoft continuing their 50th year celebrations. Now, just one more story before we hop into our interview with Tony and Stu. They're on the way in a minute. But also nice to see the Sega Saturn getting some love as well. Because you and I were complaining about this a while ago, weren't we, Joe? We're saying Mega Drive gets a lot of love. A lot of stuff's coming out on the Dreamcast. Where's the affection for the Saturn?
Where is the love? Where is the love? Yeah. You know what? Sometimes I just think maybe I'm just in the wrong groups for it. But yeah, I don't see as much for the Saturn as I do for the Mega Drive, or anywhere near as much as I do for the Dreamcast. But I thought this was a nice quick little story. So we've got a Brazilian developer and YouTuber, Naysan, and he's revealed a homebrew beat-em-up that he's been working on for the Sega Saturn, which is currently based on the famous anime Dragon Ball, which I've mentioned it before. I'm a massive Dragon Ball Z fan, Dragon Ball fan. Mm. So love to see this. But, you know, obviously it's like, okay, it's, you know, it's a famous IP, which is huge. Can't release this. But at the moment, this isn't like the finished product. This is just a kind of like a proof of concept and demo for him to then go make his original, you know, kind of original IP or game. What he's done is he has made a beat-em-up, side-along beat-em-up for the Sega Saturn, and used it as like, made the game engine for it. So completely from the ground up, new brand new game engine for the Sega Saturn, which the main kind of draw of it is the smooth kind of like scrolling and animation.
And the scaling as well.
The scaling that literally beat me to it. The scaling in it looks absolutely fantastic. So what he's actually done is he's used assets from a Game Boy Advance game called Dragon Ball Advance Adventure, which is a fantastic beat 'em up. So he used all the kind of sprites from that and backgrounds from that. But then he's also used assets from a Saturn graphics library, SGL for short, which I'm not too familiar with, but I'm assuming it's a shared kind of like assets website or something that people use for Sega Saturn homebrewing. And for a proof of concept, this game looks really, really awesome, really smooth, really, you know, really nice sound and everything like that. But I think what's exciting is what will come from it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've kind of like, for me, you know, Beats of Rage for the Mega Drive, you know, that's huge. You know, people are really still to this day releasing like homebrews and Beats of Rage and stuff. That's what I'd like to see this become.
It's such a great engine. Good point there. Yeah. Because, yeah, you know, people can put their own stuff on it and modify titles.
That's what I'm hoping he'll do. I mean, he might just release his own game and, you know, kind of like, you know, kickstart it or something like that, you know, which is also really, really cool. But if he kind of releases this out there for people to then put their own stuff into and make their own homebrews, you know, it could get really, really big and make an even bigger kind of like demo homebrew scene for the Sega Saturn, which I think would be really cool.
And it sounds obvious, but looking at it, it does look so Saturn, doesn't it? It looks like it's taking advantage of the hardware, which a lot of games kind of didn't back in the day. So it's nice to see it actually utilizing the hardware and unlocking its powers.
Yeah, 100%. Like, for me, the Sega Saturn was always like, it made 2D arcade games. Like, it really brought them home.
It was an arcade machine, wasn't it? Yeah,
it was. It was an arcade machine for 2D games, like X-Men Children of Atom and stuff like that, and the early X-Men versus Marvel games and stuff. I think they all looked fantastic on the Sega Saturn. And, you know, I'm trying to think of some other games. This reminds me of the look of like Guardian Heroes. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. Just like, yeah, you say the look of it is, it's so hard to describe over a podcast, but it is so
Have a look at the video. We'll put it in the show.
I never understood Dragon Ball, but then I played played a game called Bid for Power, which was a Quake 3 mod, which was a Dragon Ball Z one. I played that for ages and I really got into that. So yeah, even though no concept of the game or anything, I was like, this is a wicked mod.
I never played that one. I loved Dragon Ball Z. I grew up on that stuff, you know, on Cartoon Network and stuff. But yeah, I'm more excited to see what this might become.
Yeah, as I say in this article on Time Extension, don't get too attached to the Dragon Ball theme.
Yeah.
It's just basically an engine, isn't it, that will hopefully give us some really nice Sega Saturn optimized polished fighting games. So, and they always feel really at home on that platform. So be awesome to see what becomes of that. So you want to check out the video and all the rest of the stories. I do it every week. I put them in your show notes. So you don't have to Google around for them or anything like that. Click straight through from the podcast app or head to the website for the links at theretrohour.com. Now, end of every month, normally we do our patrons hangout. It is a bank holiday weekend here in the UK this coming weekend, which we know means family plans for most people. So if you haven't joined us for a hangout before, you have still got a bit of time to join our patrons. We're going to move it to next Sunday, aren't we? We're going to do it on Sunday, the 1st of June, just because we know a lot of people are going to be away for the bank holiday. So if you'd like to join us for that, it's basically a massive Zoom call, Google Meets actually, where we all get together and geek out for a couple of hours. End of the month on a Sunday. You can also check out video versions.
Yes, we've been doing video recordings of the interviews, and there's going to be one of this week's as well. That's such an old way of saying it, video recordings.
you can see our lovely face.
Yeah, and, you know, we're going to be releasing a few to the public as well and kind of see what the reaction of that is. But, you know, patrons, you get them first, and we've got exclusives out there. And also, I'd just like to say a big shout to Simon as well, who is a patron, who saw me last week in real life and said hi.
Whereabouts?
Yeah, that was really nice. At my Amiga group, and he turned up and he said, love the podcast. So that was really cool to see. You know, it's fantastic bumping into patrons and seeing you guys at shows and stuff.
Yeah, you really are the lifeblood of the podcast. We couldn't do it without you. So if you'd like to join our wonderful patrons community and our little Discord channel, we shouldn't underestimate that. You know, we're often chatting away in there with our patrons all week. So you can head to theretrohour.com. Links to sign up and join our wonderful community and support the podcast can be found there. All right, then next, keep it here. We are going to be talking to Revolution Software superstar Tony Warriner and Sensible Software legend Stu Cambridge all about their incredible new Spectrum Next games and lots more as well. They're coming up next on the Retro Hour podcast.
So you're listening to the Retro Hour, and we're here today with two absolute legends that are creating their own retro title, and that is Tony Warriner and Stu Cambridge as well. So Tony is from Revolution Software, which, you know, it's an absolutely amazing company. They produced Broken Sword, but also Beneath a Steel Sky, which is one of my personal favourites. And then Stu Cambridge is an artist with a great history in sensible software as well, with those lovely little pixels that he was creating for Cannon Fodder and Sensible World of Soccer. And they have come together to create a new British game, which looks really interesting. And it's good to see something kind of emerging from these two companies. And I was wondering first as well, like, it's time to kind of, you know, heap a bit of praise on each other. And I was just wondering, Tony, like, what were your thoughts of Sensible Software originally?
I mean, it's quite a long time ago since the real heyday of what Stu was doing. I guess that mirrors pretty much my experience. You know, I mean, Revolution did its best stuff in the 90s, mid 90s, and I suppose the same is true of Sensible. And we weren't competitors back at the time, but you know, we knew who all the good people were, and obviously Sensible was right up there. And maybe Stu had heard of us, I don't know, but we have that shared 90s experience. And then probably that experience continues, because I mean, the industry changed for all of us, and it became harder to run our companies in the way that we wanted and write the kind of games that we wanted. And like a lot of people, we've had a less creative couple of decades since that time when we did our best work, I suppose. Hopefully not really our fault, but just the way the industry changed and it became more corporate. And, you couldn't just go off and get a nice publishing deal for a game that sounded like it was going to be a bunch of fun and written by five people. You know, it all changed quite a lot. But it has changed again, because the thing goes in cycles within cycles. And now you can pretty much do anything you want. And I suppose when we sat next to each other at Zap that first time two years ago and got chatting, we kind of realized that there was nothing stopping us doing exactly what we wanted to do again. We just kept talking from there. And the end result is what we have now, you know, Urbex Warriors, which we're pretty excited about. I mean, we don't know if anyone else will be, but it appears to be a nice little game, which is what we both just want to do, create nice little games, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, both of your companies were unique in the fact that they did computer titles, but they also went on to console, and they had, like, you know, mass popularity as well, especially like Broken Sword going onto the PlayStation as well. That was really interesting. But I was wondering, like, Stu, what you thought of Revolution Software?
Well, I mean, like, as Tony said, you know, we weren't rivals. I mean, there's a lot of, I'd say, big hitters, you know, big hitters developers who had the AAA sort of stuff. And I was fortunate enough to be part of that sort of label with the stuff that we was doing at Sensible. And to be honest, I mean, it's pretty much what Tony said. I mean, this is why we kind of hit it off, because when we first sort of got together at Zap, which was, seems longer than that, but it was only a couple of years ago, we kind of just shared the same kind of views of what game development should be about, and also how the industry really doesn't reward developers anymore. It's just kind of this kind of, I don't know, just factory mentality of just churning stuff out and keeping to a formula. And we just got talking, and we found that, yeah, there's a few things we could do. And I think we just joked about, oh, maybe we should do a game one day. And here we are, you know, sitting here 2 years later, and we've got a game that's on its way to being finished.
Do you think, like, some of it is the kind of style and humour of British games as well? Because, we've started to see Thank Goodness You're Here and stuff, and a lot of kind of new indie games come out with that style that's a lot of fun, and that lends its hand to stuff like the Spectrum. And some of the Sensible titles I remember were really funny as well. Do you think that's something that you also wanted to add in?
I think so. I think the humour plays a huge part in certainly our sort of view of game design. I mean, we've had many a time just laughing over stupid things, really. But then when you filter out all the silliness, there can be a spark of a really good idea underneath, and then you can put that back into the game design. I think, yeah, that'd be really good. And I think that is really British, isn't it? It is a British thing. I mean, we all did sort of stupid things when we was developing games, like little Easter eggs we put in the games, and, you know, silly photo shoots and all that sort of stuff. And I think when you compare what we did in the UK to, say, like stateside, where they tend to be, for the most part, a little bit more serious, or take themselves more seriously, then I think, yeah, I think the whole Britsoft thing is kind of laced with humour. And certainly the games we did at Sensible was always filled with humour. You know, sometimes we added the humour in as part of the game design. Other times it just kind of happened. You know, I mean, a classic with Cannonford was the farmer, get off my land, and things like that. And the birds flying around, the little body floating, and you could shoot the body. Just silly little things like that. And they're totally sort of irrelevant to playing the game, actually getting through the game, but they add to it. It's all these little touches that really add to what makes a game great. And I think we're trying to achieve the same kind of thing of what we're doing now with Urbex Warriors.
I remember a lot of humour in Beneath a Steel Sky as well.
The thing was, no one was telling us what to do, really. So, you know, we used to just go in on the weekend and twiddle our thumbs and think, well, it would be funny. And, you know, we'd go, wouldn't it be funny if this happened? And then the artist, if there was an artist in the office, he'd go away and draw it, and then I'd implement it, and we'd laugh about it, and we'd just leave it in, you know. And sometimes Charles would find it and go, "Ha, that's pretty funny of you guys," you know. But it would stay in the game, you know. When we wrote that line, "It's crap, son," you know, when he asks about his robot, I mean, we thought it was hilarious, but it stayed in, and it stayed in the game. But later, you know, when you're working on a project with a huge budget and producers all over the place and publisher breathing down your neck, that stuff, it generally doesn't go in, but if it did, it would probably get taken out again, you know, because it's not what you should do, you know. But, you know, we just do what we want now, so there will be a ton of humour and hidden stuff in this game for certain.
Well, you didn't go straight into this game as well. You worked on a Wormhole Dungeon as well together. What was that kind of like?
Yeah, that was my game, what I was doing before I kind of met Stu at Zap. So, and then, you know, we did collab on that for a while. And it's probably that game, I mean, it's a similar thing really, but it kind of grew really huge, and slightly overwhelming. So I think the plan with that one will be to come back to it and do it justice, do it properly, rather than, when we can afford to do what we want. With that one, but you know, yeah, and the timeline's interesting because we were tentatively doing that, and then Chris Wilkins of Fusion Retro was talking to us about the next and trying to get us interested in doing something for the next computer. So you know, when we were feeling a little bit overwhelmed with Wormhole, we kind of thought, yeah, let's do something smaller for the next, just to get ourselves going. And of course what happens is, you know, you start on something small, and then everyone gets enthusiastic, and when the thing starts to look like it's going to be something quite good, it naturally grows a bit as well. So I mean, mm-hmm. Urbex has actually grown to be a fairly involved and big and sizable project, but it's not out of control. So we can deal with it and finish it and get what we want from it in terms of quality and whatnot. So.
Well, would you be able to explain what the next is as well to listeners? Because we've got a lot of international listeners, and it's a very kind of unique British thing as well, a follow-on from the Spectrum.
I mean, the Spectrum was an early 80s machine, 8-bit machine with a Z80 processor and fairly weak technical spec. I mean, it was good for the time, but it was probably, and I don't want to get lynched in the street for saying the wrong thing, but it was like a Commodore 64, but not quite as powerful in terms of sprites, you would say, and audio and things like that. So it was one of those machines back in the 80s, 40 odd years ago. And back in like 2017 or something, a bunch of very clever people, many of them involved the original machine, like the industrial designer and people like that, got together and said, let's make a new one, and base it around FPGA technology. So they did that. And of course, as with all these projects, you get more ambitious as you start thinking about it. So that machine, I mean, it's a Spectrum at its core. It's got hardware sprites and hardware scrolling and a ton of memory and all these things. So it's kind of like imagining being back in the early 90s and the Amiga and the PC hadn't, and then the PlayStation hadn't taken over the games industry. Instead, the old 8-bit machines continued to evolve. Mm. So you could probably place the Spectrum next on a timeline in the early 90s, and it would fit perfectly. The only difference is different things happened at that time. But now, like a lot of things, in the way that we can go back and write the games we want, people can make the machines they want as well. And Spectrum Next is basically that. I mean, they're quite hard to get hold of because they've just been done, not manufactured on a limited run via Kickstarters. But there are clones now which you can get. There are emulators that you can get so you can play the games on PCs and Macs and all the rest of it. And there will be another Kickstarter with fresh manufactured machines announced very soon. So it's a healthy and vibrant scene. So we kind of got placed into the middle of that and it fits what we want to do as well. So it made a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm seeing quite a few titles come out for it at the moment. And I was kind of wondering, Stu, you know, you were a Commodore guy. So, you know, approaching this kind of new Spectrum, were you like cautious at the beginning?
Well, can I just say that you're spot on. I have been, and I suppose I still am a Commodore guy at heart because I, you know, grew up with the 64 VIC-20 Amiga. So when we were talking to Chris Wilkins about Spectrum Next, I had no idea what the machine, I'd heard of it, but I had no idea what the machine actually could do and what its hardware was like. I'd seen it a few years before a retro event where it was on display, and Jim Bagley had it out, and he'd show me like the boxes and he'd show me the machine. And that was about two or three years before me and Tony were talking about this project. But for me, I was kind of intrigued initially because I thought, well, okay, let's see what this machine is all about. And then when you start looking beneath the surface, you see it's got hardware sprites, which is always a great thing. Hardware scrolling, which is great. And then you look at, like, it's got an increased color palette. So, the palette's very similar to the ST. It's got like a 512 colours you can choose from. It's not the best palette, you know, if I'm honest, but it's a major leap forward from the original Spectrum, which only had like 16, I think. So when you look at all these elements and you put them in perspective, you think this is like a kind of a natural evolution of what the Spectrum probably would have been. They probably would have done something like this if it had carried on like Tony had just said. So for me, going on to it, I thought, well, yeah, this looks like something I can really get my teeth into. And of course, you start playing around with a few like graphics, you get your palette set up, you get the hardware, you know, reference in front of you so you know what you're trying to do. And then you think, well, this is pretty capable. And I kind of started playing around, and I have to say, it was quite hard initially because I've been so used to doing 24-bit graphics and, you know, even if it's pixel art, you've got like a, you know, 24-bit palette and there's no worry about colour palettes or anything like that. You just draw them and, you know, it's done, you know, transparencies, you know, alpha channels and stuff like that. Well, this hasn't got any of that. So it was quite hard initially to get my brain adjusted into working on an older style format. But once you get settled in, you kind of think, okay, I think we can do something really cool on this machine. And we just started sort of just moving forward with an idea for a game. And it just takes over.
Well, how did that idea come about then? Did you guys like meet in the pub and suddenly come up with this idea? What was its inspiration?
Well, originally we just joked about doing a game, and there was a project we was going to do with Chris, and we kind of started some concept work on that, and it just didn't. Something happened which suggested it probably won't go anywhere. So we thought, we've got this kind of like start of an engine which we'd been working on. And we thought, right, okay, what games do we like? You know, and we liked 80s and 90s sort of arcade games. We like things where you roam around, adventure games. I'm going to say Gauntlet, but I don't. It's not based on Gauntlet, so I've got to get that get out of the way because people say, "Oh, you're doing a Gauntlet game." It's like it's not. So initially, we was going to do like just a straight arcade game, but as Tony said, we've kind of added extra stuff into it. There's like traps, puzzles, things you can unlock. There's going to be a little bit of interaction with other characters in the game as you go along that might give you some clues, and we just felt that we could do this project and really make the next look like it wasn't a next, if that makes sense. You know, the idea being that we could put it in an arcade cabinet, put it in an arcade, and people wouldn't be none the wiser that the Spectrum Next would be underneath. You know, that's the gist of what we're trying to achieve.
And you felt the system had enough grunt to do that as well?
I think so. I mean, Tony's probably more qualified to answer that because I'm always saying, can we do this, can we do that? And obviously the engine that Tony's creating, it's really pushing the hardware in. And it's all in Z80 as well, so we're really pushing it.
We started off quite conservatively. You know, we were going to have a level-based game and, you know, here's a level and you venture and you move on to the next level and you just take a linear path. And then we realized that it's got so much memory and so much power that we should start saving the state. And once you say that, then, you know, you can go back and forth between levels. And then your game naturally designs itself to take advantage of that. And so, you know, more elaborate puzzles set across different areas and all the rest of it. So it all unfolded into a much more complicated game. You know, so it started as a single level based arcade game and little things from games that we really like in my case, Secret of Mana, which I think is one of the greatest pixel art games that, you know, ever made. It's such a clever little thing, and so well polished. So little time, you know, we're gravitating up towards games like that appeal to us so much and that we admire greatly. So there's little influences coming from all over the place, and that's how it's snowballed into this slightly bigger project.
I look at a few of the screenshots and I kind of think Zombies Ate My Neighbours as well, which was a pretty good one.
Can I just say that it was really funny because we showed a demo at Crash Live last year. I think it was in November. And when I did the graphics for the first levels that you play in the game, it's based around like South America, like Machu Picchu and like Tiwanaku and Pumapunku, all these ancient South American sites, you know, where there's like destroyed rocks and stuff, and stone. And I was doing these H blocks, which if you look into that part of the world, there's these H blocks, which they can't work out how they were made because they're precision cut. You know, the engineering on it was amazing. They reckon they all fit together. So I thought, well, I'll draw influences from that into the artwork. Well, I did these walls and I thought, I need something to break that up visually because it's just stone and you've got grass and a few rocks. So I thought, why not? I'll do some shrubbery, like a hedge of some kind. So I just drew this hedge, didn't think any more of it. So we took it to Crash and people were saying, oh, Zombies Ate My Neighbours. No, it's not. But then we looked at it and we thought, actually, I can see what people mean because that had hedges in it. And so, yeah, that's a pure fluke and a pure coincidence that's comparison. I'm not going to knock it because that's, you know, it's a great game. You know, it's a great game on the Mega Drive. So, yeah.
I was wondering as well, like Urbex Explorers, it's urban exploration, right? Is that something that any of you guys have partaken in? Have you done any exploring of abandoned buildings or anything like that?
A little bit. I mean, I super love that stuff. I mean, I'm not doing the YouTube type stuff, which is really quite scary, some of it, and you know, I don't want to die in some wreck of a building somewhere. But there was a lot of stuff around Hull where I was living before when we started this project, and there's all sorts of stuff you can go and wander around. And
near the docks, there was a big area. Yeah, I'd actually been around a few warehouses there.
Right, exactly those ones. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I think they had a big graffiti scene, and there was a documentary on it years ago. So I
went that's pretty much what I'm talking about. So we'd often go look around that stuff, and it was a bit scary because you don't know who's in there and things like that. I like that whole thing and idea of a sort of a post-apocalypse. It gives you a feeling of post-apocalypse and that everything's gone and there's nothing much left and everything's wrecked and you're just exploring it, looking for stuff. You know, it's a bit like Walking Dead. I mean, my favorite part of Walking Dead is is the fact that they go exploring stuff, and you get a little feeling of that when you go around old buildings that have been abandoned, you know. That whole thing was quite appealing. But then we thought about it a bit more, and it seems like a really good idea, a really good premise for a video game. And it hasn't really been done as such. You don't see it. I mean, there's lots of Urbex stuff everywhere, but you don't see it in video games much. So it seemed like a great premise.
I see a lot of it in the press, as well as when people do stuff and it like gets headlines, and it's like these places people have always wanted to go and wondered what's inside there.
Yeah. I went to Deep Book Blue in Croatia the other year, and you know, there's the fancy hotel with the conference and all the rest of it. But if you walk like half a mile down the beach, you come to a set of massive, great resort hotels that have been abandoned the last 30 years. From the war that they had, they got shelled and it was too damaged to be repaired. So you can just wander into all of that and go up these concrete staircases into deeper and deeper into this complex. And I was thinking, wow, this is amazing. I mean, I'm meant to be at the conference learning how to do industry stuff, but this Urbex business around the corner is far more fun, you know. So I spent ages doing that. It was brilliant.
I think the main thing for me was that it gives us an opportunity to be quite experimental with game design, because the whole premise of exploring is you can go anywhere. So, and with this, we kind of talked about it. We thought, well, that really fits with the game we was hoping to make. We thought, what could we do? And it kind of fitted in, and it just kind of worked. And the main thing really is just trying to look at how you can take that idea and put it into a game for the next, because we are working under quite a restrictive hardware when you compare it to, say, what you can get on your PC or your modern console. So we've kind of tailored the game design to that, but retained that kind of Urbex feel throughout. So you'll find things in the game which, you know, although it's like ancient, you'll see things that are a bit modern. You know, might be some pieces of modern stuff in there which we'll be putting around. But yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated. I mean, I haven't done any urban exploring in my later years, but certainly when I was a kid, there was an old abandoned banana kind of warehouse factory where I lived, and had the old railway line still running to it, and it was all overgrown, and you could go in there and you used to go through this path behind the school, and you'd go through this path and all trees, and there'd be a footpath you'd find, and there'd be someone who'd have made a camp, and there'd be all block bits hanging down, but you'd keep going, and you'd go to this, I think it was Fife's who that did the bananas, and you'd go in and you could climb up, and it'd be like you was in this, it would open up where they did all the packaging and the unloading of the railway for all the bananas that were coming in. It was amazing. And I suppose part of that stuck with me, and it kind of triggered something when we was talking about doing this game. And we both said that we've seen, you know, various videos on YouTube where these guys and girls go around and they explore all these places, and you think, wow. And some pretty like, you know, touchy, where you're going to get out alive because the floors give way, and you think, wow. But what a great recipe for a game design. It's fantastic, you know.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it opens lots of elements up to puzzle as well.
Exactly.
You know, exploring these, and especially having it in an international setting as well, with all the references you were talking about, like the Mayan temples and how many different locations do you have in the game then?
Well, we've had to be kind of like Tony said, we've kind of run with it, but we've kind of controlled it, so we're not going off at a tangent and just never ending the game. Originally we was gonna have fives, but there's four distinct graphical styles in the game, and there is a possible fifth. So you basically start off in like the outside, which is all like green, and you've got like derelict stone. And the premise of the game is they're exploring this ancient site near where they kind of grew up. And they think they're in an ancient temple, and they go underground, and they realise that it's not quite a temple. It opens up, and it's actually more like an underground city, which gives us lots of freedom to basically do what we want visually and with the creative side. And it just becomes more paranormal as you go through. So you start off, as I say, on the outside. As you get further in, you get into the next area, which is more your kind of stone construction and more kind of what you'd expect to see from an ancient civilization that's buried. And then as you get a little bit further in, it gets a little bit darker and you get more paranormal stuff happening. And then the last area is kind of going to be all sort of fire, lava, and you've got this real kind of hellish kind of environment. But there might be another area which we put in. We'll see how it goes, because we're trying to keep the game fairly sort of regulated with what we do, because we don't want to run away with feature creep, because it's very easy just to run off at a tangent and say, well, let's have this, this, and this, and this. And then before you know it, you've got another 6 months of development and you think, oh no. So we're trying to be quite managed with what we do. But, I'd say 4/5 graphical differences. And within each of those, you've got different styles. So for instance, when you're on the outside, you can go through like a door and you're inside a cave sort of area, which will be another style of graphics. And then we've got areas called link levels, where they're basically connection levels between areas, and they're more like corridors or bendy corridors. And again, that'll be a slightly different graphical style. So if you add all those together, you know, that's quite a lot. You know, it's like 16 sort of variants of graphics.
Lots to see. I could tell you're really enjoying it. And I was wondering, have you spent a lot of time building these asset sets? Because I know you're going to be going onto other platforms as well. And, you know, preparing for the future. I think it's, you're looking for the Switch, Dreamcast as well, Amiga and PlayStation. So, you know, there's also a PC and Mac version. So I was wondering, having this as, you know, your primary platform, the Spectrum next, and then going out to this other thing, has there been processes that you've had to do?
Well, one of the side effects of beginning on a relatively constrained platform is that you have to concentrate on what is the core, you know, what is the core of this game, and you can't just run away in any random direction. I mean, I think the reason a lot of games go wrong or don't even get finished is just because they feature creep outwards and get too big and people lose control of them. I mean, you know, there's a million and one Unity type projects that people go, oh yeah, assets, plugins, and then it's a great big sprawling mess and it never gets finished because it just lacked focus. And if you're one thing about working on what is essentially an 8-bit platform, you know, it can only get so big. So as long as we get what we do correct, then the whole thing should be reasonably good. And then when it goes onto a PlayStation or a Dreamcast or whatever, or a Switch, we the base that we've got is hopefully all good. Then we just polish it and iterate on the good stuff rather than kind of drifting around as developers are often want to do.
I think it's really interesting that we're seeing some Spectrum Next games being the primary platform, and then wider audiences actually, you know, getting involved when it goes onto these other systems. It's really something that's kind of, you know, back then saying, oh, the Spectrum would be the primary one for the PlayStation. So it's something kind of unconceivable, but such a small user base. And also I can imagine that there's a lot of software development tools as well. How important has stuff like C-Spect been? And
C-Spect is absolutely vital, yeah. I mean, it would have been very difficult without C-Spect. It's such a good emulator and so fast to use that, you know, the actual programming and development environment is really very good. It's very quick to iterate, much, much quicker and much more usable than something like Unity or Unreal, which are sort of bogged down in processes that slow the whole thing down, you know, unless you've got like a Cray 10 running the thing, you know. So it's the tools. I mean, there's a lot of stuff it's fairly granular. You know, you're sprite grabbing, you're pressing things, you're booting up the emulator. It's all pretty low level stuff, but it slots together quite nicely, and it's just you end up with a pretty nice environment, you know.
Yeah, I mean, for me, going back to the original question with the you know, the base level of the next, I mean, what Tony said is spot on. You've got like a machine which has got like a very limited color palette, you know, 512 colors, and with the tile sets, they're like 256 colors for a tile set, which is great. But when you've only got a 512 color palette, you haven't really got as much freedom as you originally thought. So when we come to port it, say for instance the Amiga version, which, you know, which will be an AGA only title, I'll be taking those graphics and they'll be all enhanced and updated so they'll look smoother on the Amiga. And we're going to use this kind of like I suppose, design philosophy for every platform we do. So with the Dreamcast one, there'll be like lots of extra effects in the game. And so even some of the levels will probably be expanded, to be honest, because again, because with the NEX, we're kind of quite constrained. We're trying to be quite managed to what we do with it. On other formats, we can certainly expand it and have levels which are a little bit bigger and expand the whole game so that you're not getting the same game on, say, if you buy the next version and then later on you want to see the Dreamcast version or the Amiga, the game will be an enhanced version of that. So it will actually be, it's almost like a, I'm not going to say like a plus one, but it'll be like a, you know, Urbex Warriors 1.2 and with extra bits for that particular machine.
I can imagine it's like you're not downgrading at all. You're kind of upgrading the game for each little system and customizing it. I guess there's going to be stuff like achievements and stuff in the Switch version as well.
Yes, yeah, we'll work on the strengths of the platform we're going to be developing it for. I mean, the key for us is to get this first game right, got to get this dead right, and thankfully the feedback we've had so far from people just playing it has been really great. And as you know, when you're working on a project and you're sitting at your desk and you're communicating and you're doing stuff, until you get it out in front of the public and they start playing it and giving you feedback, you can be kind of like a bit unsure whether what you're doing is actually going to hit a nerve and say, yeah, this is what we like. You know, we like this game. And you don't know until somebody's testing it. And so far, we've had some brilliant feedback. So
yeah, what's the reaction been like? Because I know you've recently showed it and you're going to be showing it again at other shows.
Yeah, the funniest thing was when we showed it at Crash, we had people walking past and they didn't realise it was running on a Next. They thought it was on a high-spec machine. They looked at it and thought, they couldn't believe it. And we said, no, the machine is actually sitting there. Look, it's plugged in. There's the joystick. There's the power light. There's the HDMI socket. It's actually on the Next. They just didn't realise it was actually running on the Next, which is brilliant for us because that's an achievement for us. It's an achievement unlocked. Yeah. I mean, when I started doing the graphics, I wanted to kind of create something that looked like a Neo Geo game. So I've kind of inspired by the SNK style and like from the logo, some of the presentation and even the main characters, I've kind of drawn inspiration from that kind of Japanese style of artwork. Only because I wanted to make sure that it appealed to arcade players. And what better way than to kind of look at something like the SNK library and go, yeah, we can draw inspiration from that. But yeah, it was really cool seeing people's reactions. It was nerve wracking initially, but I mean, we had Zap this recent weekend, and the same reaction was there. It was brilliant.
I mean, I was wondering what the reaction from the Next team's been as well, because like a title like this actually really justifies the Next project. You know,
it was quite well as Stu was saying back at Crash, we kept getting little delegations of Next team people coming and having a look at it because people and then they'd go back and tell other people and it's like the hardware guys and that would keep going. Oh yeah, this is actually not bad at all. Asking us questions about it and how we'd done it, you know, it was quite gratifying, wasn't it?
It was very gratifying. It was great.
Have you added a lot of that kind of British charm in the game as well? And, you know, some of that humour that we were talking about earlier.
We've got little chat heads at the bottom. So when you're playing the game, you choose two characters, one of two. You've got Ramona and you've got Alejandro. So when you choose which character you want to be, their little chat head will appear at the bottom. So when they come up against something, they'll have a little message will pop up. But we've also just put ourselves in the game as well. So one of us will pop up with something which is neutral to what the player's doing along the way. And we can trigger text all through the game. And the idea being that there will be clues as you're going through that will help you along your way in certain spots where you might think that, you know, what am I doing? And it might give you a little indication of something. But most of it's a little bit humorous. So there's lots of little wisecracks that come up.
We kind of take the mickey occasionally of yes. what the player's doing. Like if they screw up badly, we'll have a laugh at them, you know, because we're just like there. It's like, you know, in the Muppets, the two guys in the balcony. There's a little bit of that from us. Yes.
Yeah, I was going to say, I love the idea of the developers in the game actually just like, you know, being there the whole time, just winding you up, you know.
We want to be in the game. We can put ourselves in. No one can stop us.
I was wondering then, you know, you guys are going to launch a Kickstarter soon. Could you let us know about it? And also, how stuff like the distribution of the game is going to be handled and the packaging as well.
I mean, part of doing a Kickstarter is because it's a great place for an indie to do promotion. So that's part of the thinking with the Kickstarter. You know, it just focuses attention on the project. So that I think will work quite good. Because just chucking a game at Steam or something is not a simple process these days at all. And I think Kickstarter is probably better for us. The physical stuff, I mean, we just love the old physical stuff with boxes and good things that we used to get. So it's a good way to do that kind of thing as well. So, you know, we're very much quality orientated. So, you know, we're going to have a really good box and really good manual, and everything we put in there is going to be top-notch stuff. So Kickstarter is the best way to do and present that kind of thing. So there'll be a lot of manufacturing to sort out, but, you know, that's part of the job when you self-publish these days. Distribution will be through Fusion Retro, so Chris Wilkins, who's got a lot of experience of dealing with that kind of thing, and you know, the regulations that we have to put up with these days with sending things to Europe and whatever, which I think might have just got slightly simpler, but we'll have to see on that.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of complication with sending things, but, you know, Chris has got the experience with that, so
I can you know, also imagine that Stu would really want to get in with that manual, because I know you've been doing lots of illustrations as well, and getting that manual, that art, that whole kind of storyline in there as well.
Yeah, I mean, part of the you know, part of the background of the game is that coming up with believable stories for the characters, you know, where they met, did they grow up, where they grew up. I've written a few, like, you know, I've written a few paragraphs on each one. I've got an idea in my head, like a much bigger story, which we can then use later on if we, you know, when we do other projects in the series. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I did the cover art, which was a lot of work to do, but because we knew we had to do the Kickstarter, we was going to do a Kickstarter with the project. I thought, well, we need assets to use for the campaign. So what better way than to create a really nice detailed piece of artwork? And we can use all those assets for promotion and after, you know, after the game's published, we can then, you know, do like collectibles with it. You know, we've got the posters, you've got, like, you know, mouse mats, whatever. But like Tony said, everything we do, we've set the bar really high from the start. And once you set that bar high, you have to live up to that through everything you do, from selling a mouse mat to a poster to a collectible item that we might, you know, we can put in with the box. Everything is going to be, it's got to be high. So it's a lot of work, but quality is key for us. We have to make sure that maintain that image that we are giving you a quality title, and everything that comes with it will be a quality product associated with it. So, you know, it's what we're about. You know, I mean, we collaborated on this project, and we've created a name for ourselves called Brazen Gameplay, which is what we're going to be known as, and that kind of sums up what we're about. You know, it's all about the gameplay, and we're not holding back. You know, this is what we do.
And also, I kind of think that quality and the effort that you're putting in is fantastic, and aiming for the Spectrum Next as well as a kind of release brings a lot of attention to it. As you know, Tony said earlier, with Steam, lots of titles are released, don't get that much attention, you know, can kind of get washed away. And having this kind of Spectrum release makes it really stand out. I was wondering, with the other systems then, do you have a timeline, or is it all going to come out at once? I can imagine that's going to be a lot of work. Or are you going to have a staggered kind of release, or will that be separate from the Kickstarter?
No, I mean, we will do this one, and then we'll look at what the next platforms will be. And because we're going to put so much extra work into each one, you know, we're not doing sort of quick ports or anything like that. You know, you're not going to see the same game but running on a PlayStation. It's going to be massively enhanced with PlayStation in whatever way the PlayStation we feel can excel. You know, we'll play to the strengths of every machine. So that, I mean, that takes time to do. You know, if we add sort of real time lighting to a particular platform that's got the power to do it, then, you know, that needs to be programmed, and it has feedback on the art, and, you know, all these things take time, especially in such a small team. So it's not going to be quick. You know, there'll be a sizable gap between releases.
Is it going to be physically released as well, like on a
always from format? Us. Yeah, always.
Yeah. We like physical product. It's, I think, in the age of everything's a digital download, it's very easy just to kind of forget that you've got, you know, someone's hard work on your machine. Someone spent a lot of time developing that game. And for us, I think it's key that you have a physical product. You can look in your hand. You can flip through the manual. You can look at the back of the box, and you can put it on your shelf, and you can look at it on your shelf, and it's there. You've bought it. You've bought that game. It's there. And for us, it's whatever format we choose to do, there will be a physical release. You know, it's got to be that way for us. It has to be.
And you'll always own that game. And no one can take it away from you when they switch a server off. And
yeah,
we can't, because it's not met enough quarterly profits. You know, it's you're going to have that game forever on physical media.
Yeah, I was wondering, is there a way of kind of connecting it online? Any online connectivity with the Next at all? Or will you be doing that with other systems?
There are people working on systems to let you do that. I mean, you can get a Wi-Fi module in the Next, and it will connect up to the internet, and people are building sort of service type things. I mean, I wouldn't want to build that thing from scratch myself. I believe that people are working on those sorts of ideas. So it is something we might look at putting in as and when such things are available. Because, I mean, the idea is, at least on platforms where we can, is to do internet co-op play. So, you know, if we can put that into the Next at some point, then we will. If we can't, then we'll save it for other platforms. But yeah, that's definitely an idea that we're going to implement where we can.
Any idea about, you know, you're saying it's an arcade style title, like leaderboards or something like that?
Yeah, I mean the next version will have a high score table in the old school way. If a particular version of the game is on a service where you can have a proper public leaderboard, then yeah, we'll definitely do that.
Awesome. Do you have any interesting perks and bonuses that you can have in the Kickstart campaign that you can talk about?
We do.
Yes, considering it'll be out on Wednesday, so just after we release this podcast, yeah.
There's ages yet.
Yeah, we've got we're going to be doing a 12-inch vinyl of the soundtrack. Which is really good. I mean, the thing is with the Next, it's got three AY sound chips. So when you haven't got to worry about that, you know, a couple of channels disappearing for the sound effects. So we've got a 6-channel music on one of it, and it's that's pretty cool. So there'll be a selection of tracks from the game on the vinyl.
And who's responsible for the soundtrack?
Richard Faulkner is doing it.
He's had
a lot of experience with the Next. He knows the machine really well, and he's been really cool to work with, because I was quite adamant that I wanted something that had sort of influence from South America. And I wanted not necessarily be like, you know, oldie folky music from South America, but inspired from it within the video game sort of soundtrack. And he's got it. He's taken what I requested and said, yeah, this is what I can do. And the music he's been doing recently for it is really working well. So that's really good. And the other thing we're going to be having some posters, and we have some t-shirts, and we're looking at having some mouse mats and maybe some coasters as well. But the big one we're having is we've teamed up with Andrew from Immortal Joysticks, and we've actually designed these very, very unique looking joysticks for the game, where you've got the two versions you can choose from. One with the Ramona, which is kind of like a reddish pink colour, and one which is with the Alejandro, which is more the blue. And they've got all the artwork from the game, from the illustrations on there. And the buttons for the actual sticks are actually the eyeballs from the zombie. So you'll be whacking the zombie's eyes every time you fire or whack somebody. So, but they look absolutely amazing.
And they're top quality as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, really, if solid. Anybody knows their stuff, they know Immortal Joysticks is probably the best, you know, ones you can buy for the money. And they're solid, very solid sticks. And again, because we wanted to, you know, we're aiming high, they are a bit more expensive, but you know, they are the top quality you can get, and they are sturdy, and they look fantastic, absolutely fantastic.
And if our listeners are wondering as well, Richard Faulkner, we had him on the podcast before, he's a man in the techno shed.
That's right, yes.
Which is his YouTube channel, and he's got a fantastic setup. And he's also developed some Spectrum titles himself,
yes.
And Spectrum, yes. Next ones as well. So there's a good connection with the chipset and the sound there.
Yeah, he's a good technology guy, actually. He's helped us with a lot of stuff, helped me with coding stuff I didn't know. And his music's certainly not my area of expertise, but he's been extremely good, yeah. A lucky find.
So I was wondering, do you think with this kind of ecosystem of developers and publishers and people around the Spectrum, you would have been able to do this on your own, or has it been kind of essential in getting it out there and getting it to the stage it is?
I think from, as you were saying, the tools, I mean, without the people working on the platform providing stuff that we've used, we certainly couldn't have done it, because we'd have spent all this amount of time writing tools and emulators and stuff. So, the community is a very close-knit one, and you know, you can, whoever's working on the thing that you're using, you can just ping them online and they'll tell you things and help you and stuff. So, contrast that to AAA. You know, could you get into the lead developer at Unity or Unreal? Probably not. You'd be finding a ticket somewhere and hoping that someone will help you, you know. So, you know, the beauty of the community, the development community, is you can find someone who knows the answer and just ask them, and you'll get help. So, I mean, yeah, that sort of thing is extremely valuable.
I was wondering, do you have any, like, future plans for future games? Or are you kind of got them hidden away and you're going to focus on this?
We do. We were talking about ideas at Zap, in the pub, obviously, but we've got two really strong ideas that we want to do immediately. Of course, we've got a lot of other things to do meanwhile, but yeah, there's a couple of extremely nice ideas bubbling away.
Yeah. It's I'd say watch this space, because we're hoping to, to do some really cool stuff in the future. I'm not going to say no more than that, but they're going to be humour, a lot of humour in the games. Very British.
We were walking down the street in Kenilworth and just laughing, two guys just laughing manically. We were just talking about the idea we had. So there's some good stuff coming.
Yes.
You know what? And I think these kind of indie niche games are becoming incredibly popular, and stuff like the Debug Indie Games Awards as well, and brings great attention to them. So, it's really good to see one being created for Spectrum Next, but also, other people benefiting, like the Amiga and Dreamcast as well. Could you let our listeners know where you can find information on it, and also when the Kickstarter is going to launch?
Best ways to can we give you a URL just to print somewhere?
Yes, we can put them in the show notes, definitely.
That's the easiest thing for the Kickstarter. But the release itself will be, the Kickstarter launch will be next Wednesday, I think 7 PM.
Yeah, yeah.
The idea is to have a launch party online first, so people can jump onto that and chat to us, and then it'll go live and all that kind of thing. But awesome. Next Wednesday.
Well, also I know that Stu, you've been doing some development blogs as well. So
yes, and Tony has too on his one. So we've both been writing our little blogs.
So people can keep up with those.
We've been so busy doing actual work to write about doing the work.
Yeah. But we've got a Facebook page set up for it now, so that people can follow that one. But if you go, I mean, the main thing will be the link on the Kickstarter, because that's our central hub at the moment. And it's like Tony said, it's been taking so much work to get where we are with it that you kind of forget to do things like blogs and social media. So, we're so concentrated on getting the game finished and working on it that we sometimes you forget to put a post out. I mean, my social media activity is like a sawtooth wave. It's up and down like a yo-yo. You know, I'm on there a lot and then I'm not on there at all. So,
you've got your head stuck in pixels.
I
think it's fantastic. You guys coming on, and we wish you the best of luck as well. We're really
thank you.
Looking forward thank you. To seeing the finished product at the end.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn.
and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.